Today we're going to work one of the problems that I actually posted in the notes on Thursday. I thought it'd be worthwhile to kind of take a quick peek at it. Shouldn't take very long. Then we're going to round out the chapter 2 material, okay, in terms of the theoretical, analytical part. We'll work some more examples on Thursday. Thursday we'll also spend some time talking about what will be on your exam, which is a week from Thursday. And spoiler alert, it's everything.
Did you post the homework?
I haven't pasted the solutions yet, yeah. So I'll get those up in the next day or so.
Okay.
Yeah, sorry about that. Okay, so let's take a look quickly. Problem 241. Okay, so we have, in this case, I'll draw it to match the book. Then K1, K2. And the book says, hey, assume that Y is a pure harmonic, and they give it to you in sine form. And what we want is the force on the wall, given that input in Y. So this is not really unlike a problem we talked about, kind of why I wanted to talk about it in detail, is you might have some mass like that and want to know if this thing is vibrating in some way, what's the force on my fixture? What's the force on the ground? This actually could be a model, that spring could be a model for the actual mounting system itself. Right. So this kind of problem, given some excitation, what's the force somewhere, is a common one. So this is a really simple example of that and why I wanted to take at least a minute in class to talk about it. Okay. Okay. So where do we start? Free body diagram, that's a good place to start always. Kind of forces do we have? Some spring forces. Okay. And we're assuming we're operating 1 degree of freedom horizontally, so we can kind of ignore everything else, right? Okay, what else? What's next? So I've got a coordinate system. In this case, we're in 1 degree of freedom, so it doesn't really matter so much, generally. But a good habit to be in is go ahead and draw up your coordinate system anyway. And these are steps, like I've told you guys, I do this on problems I work in my research. Yes, sir?
Just a question. For like the exam, if we're rushed on time, we don't have time to draw the free body, and we feel like we can do without it, would we lose points or
no? Well, you lose points for
not having
a free body diagram. Directly, no. But indirectly, possibly, if you got later stuff wrong and would have had a correct free body diagram. That makes sense?
Yeah.
So if you get everything else right later, yeah, I don't care. But get stuff wrong later, this is going to help me give you some partial credit. Again, you know, we'll talk more on Thursday in a lot more detail about what to expect on the exam. But what I'm trying to measure is not that you can blindly follow a procedure. I'm trying to measure, do you understand vibration stuff? Right? So if you can demonstrate that, then you're going to be okay, generally. Okay, so free body diagram, coordinate system, what's next? You pick a method. I might also say, alongside of that, pick what coordinates I'm going to use to describe the system. How many degrees of freedom?
One.
Just one, right? So Y is an input here, so it doesn't count as a degree of freedom. We have just the motion of X. So we might could map that out explicitly too. Hey, let our generalized coordinates BX. You have just 1 degree of freedom. A preference on method? Lagrange? Really? I think Newton-Euler is way easier here. Right? Not that either one of them is very hard for a mass in the spring. Okay. Okay, let's do Newton-Euler. Okay, if we're doing Newton-Euler, we'll set it up both ways. We'll take but an extra minute. What's the order of what I need in terms to describe this spring force 1? It's obviously K1 times something. Y minus x. Y minus x?
Because if y is greater than x.
That's right. So I've drawn the arrow positive that way. I need to make the magnitude of this term match that arrow. So if y is greater than x, it's going to be pushing on that mass. Right. And then the second spring is easy. Just that, right? Okay, there we have equation of motion, Lagrange. Newton-Euler, what do we need? I mean, that's Newton-Euler. We need Lagrange. What's the total kinetic energy of this guy? We have mx dot squared, right? What's the total potential energy? I have those two springs, right? So what's the potential energy from K1? We have K1 times delta 1, which we just figured out was this. That's from the second one. I have my Lagrangian. And then I know and I wrote up the whole thing there. Do we have any damping? So we know that's going to be zero. Do we have any external non-conservative forces? So we know the generalized force will be zero too. So you end up with that simplified form. And then we plug stuff in. We'll get back to that. Okay. So we have an equation of motion. Let's divide by m so we can rewrite this. What does that do for us? You have a natural frequency. What is it? Right. And so that means we can write our equation of motion that way. Okay. So, we have an equation of motion. If it forms, how do we get from that to what the force on the wall is? Sumo solution. What's the higher level thing we're looking for? If we're going to get this force on the wall, what do we need?
Displacement.
The displacement of what?
The mass.
The mass, right. So, we could draw this up if we wanted to really be explicit about it. Hey, we know if the spring is putting that much force on the mass, I should be putting that same amount on the wall. Right. So really what we're looking for is K2x is the force that's going on the wall, right? So we need x as a function of time to be able to describe that. So in that case, if we need x as a function of time, we need to get to the time response, which means solving our differential equation, right? So we're going to assume some kind of solution. What do we want to assume here? OK, could assume the exponential, and that's always going to get you to the answer. What's special about this particular case that's going to allow us to take a shortcut, maybe? We have no damping. What does that mean for the assumed solution? It's either exactly in phase or exactly out of phase of our input, right? So we can match the form of our input if we don't have damping, exactly. Okay. So we can assume that x of t is x bar sine of t in this case. We can assume x bar exactly match. If we had damping, we either have to include a cosine term or, at my recommendation, use the complex form. Okay, so I'm going to take two derivatives and plug into this guy. Sine on both sides, so we can get rid of those. And then I know that x bar now I've solved for the magnitude of that response, right? And then I have from that I know, of course, the time response. And if I know the magnitude of that time response, then what's the force? I know x of t, what's the force on the wall? Well, I'm not asking for that. We're just asking you for the description of the force. So what is it? Yeah, k2 times this. Now you have the force, the time response of the force on the wall based on pure harmonic input and y. Okay. If I wanted to write, and this is actually what the question is specifically asking you for, the transfer function between input y and the force on the wall. How do I get to that? Output over input. Okay. So I want the output. What output do we want here if we want the force on the wall? I want to transfer my knowledge of the input to some knowledge about the force on the wall. So what's the output? Yeah, it's the force on the wall, which we just said, hey, was k2x, right? So if I know, hey, the transfer function from the what's that transfer function? Yeah, so that's just from my input y to the, or magnitude of the input y, really, right? When we're talking transfer functions generally, to the output x. Okay. Well, what did we just say about the magnitude of the force? It's just k2 times that, right? So, yes, sorry about that. So we know that, hey, from, we can map, we know the position, so we know the force. It's just k2 times that, times the output, right? So we know then that this is k1, k2, is that. We had a transfer function written already from input y to displacement of x, and we know that the force on the wall is just k2 times that displacement. Yes?
So if we wanted
So you want to know from spring force here to force on the wall? Yeah, you could do similar operations. Okay. Questions about that? Yes, sir.
Can you repeat that last part about the KT time?
Yeah, so we said way back here somewhere that really the force on the wall here is just K2, it's just force spring 2, right? So K2 times what X is doing, right? Well, this transfer function tells us what X is doing given some input Y. So we know that the force then is just K2 times what X is doing over the input Y. It's the same operation we would have done in the time response. It's K2 times this to get the time history of the forcing function. That works. Multiply by a constant, whether it's, you know, frequency domain or time domain, it's the same. Other questions? Okay. So I think this, again, a pretty simple problem directly, but I think this method, this idea shows up a lot of places, right? We need to know the force our mechanism's exerting on some other body of the robotic arm or something. I don't know, right? So I can map this out. Okay, well, I know that's just the deflection of this times some spring constant, and away we go. Okay. So let's talk about (2.12). We've talked a lot about how we model vibration, how we look at frequency and time responses, those kind of things. Let's talk for a minute about how we actually might measure vibration. Right. And what it turns out is our skills in modeling vibratory systems also lend themselves to designing a sensor to sense vibration. And the two sensors we're going to talk about are accelerometers and seismometers. And they actually have, as a first approximation, an identical structure. So let's imagine a frame looks something like this. Okay. Within that frame, I have a mass. M. That is attached to the frame. With a spring and damper, K and Z. And you could consider this mass as constrained to move only in this one dimension right now. And what we have is we're able to measure that distance. Let's call it an X. Okay. So we're able to measure the absolute displacement of this mass S, mass M, from the frame it's in. Okay. And this is our sensor. So we take this guy and set him on the table and figure out how the table is vibrating. Okay. So this whole sensor frame is actually vibrating based on what we've attached it to. And that's what we're trying to measure. So we're actually trying to measure Y. So our goal here is to Measure something we know how to measure and we actually can. We can measure this distance easily. You know, we kind of two fixed places and relative distance in space. We can do that easily. Okay. We have a hard time measuring kind of absolute displacement in space, if you will. So what we're trying to do is, given some measurement of this relative displacement between the frame of the thing and its internal mass, can we then figure out what's happening to the whole sensor? You guys following the setup so far? Okay. So why is the, we'll define these just to make sure. So why is the displacement of the sensor itself? Okay. And then we say, well, x is the x is the relative displacement of that mass that's inside the sensor, the internal mass of the sensor. Okay. So let's try to figure out if we can do this. Where do you think we're going to start?
Free body
diagram. Let's do that. We have a mass. Let's assume we're operating around some equilibrium, so don't worry about gravity right now. Okay. So what kind of forces do we have? Springs and dampers. Okay. Yeah, so you're asking, why did I pick these arrows?
Yeah.
Okay. So as x gets larger, what direction are the spring and damper forces? Right, so if I hold the sensor fixed, or even if the sensor's moving, if x is getting larger, the spring is pushing down on the thing. So that's why I drew the way I did. Okay. So we have the free body diagram. What else do we need? We got coordinates, and again, we're really only at 1 degree of freedom, so it doesn't tend to matter so much yet. But be in the habit, because we're coming up on chapter 4 pretty soon, where we have multi-degree of freedom. Okay. So if we're drawing a free body diagram, probably means we're getting equations of motion, right? Okay. Let's work this with Newton-Euler. Okay. So where do I go from here? What's that? Find variables, sure. So let's describe, we're really trying to describe the displacement of x. Y, in this case, is kind of an input to what this mass is doing, right? Okay, so let's say, well, hey, we're going to describe our system. We're going to look at the displacement. That displacement x is what we're going to use to describe the motion of the system. Okay, now what? Some kind of F equals MA stuff, right? Okay. Let's look at those forces. It's the force of the spring. X. Why just X? Why doesn't Y not show up? That's right. So X is an absolute measure, basically, of this spring length, right? So exactly right. So this means that we have minus, and the kind of same argument holds. Yes, sir. Yeah, so we are kind of waving our hand at that this x at zero is springs at equilibrium. So we're we can kind of ignore that part. And largely we're going to ignore that part because that spring contribution to this overall system is going to be small compared to what we're actually trying to measure. Yeah. Small and static, so it's just a static offset of whatever we would measure. So we can kind of ignore it. Okay, so there's our forces acting on the system. What's the other side of that equation? It's the MA part, right? Gave away the answer already. What's the acceleration of that mass? We're writing Newton-Euler's equation. Using Newton-Euler, right? We have to write the total acceleration of whatever masses and bodies we're describing. What's the total? Does x answer directly? Does x describe the total acceleration of that mass?
No.
Yeah. So we have the whole frame moving, and then x is accelerating relative to the frame, right? So we need both of those to describe the total acceleration of that system. So we have our equation of motion for our simple sensor. Okay. Let's divide by m. What does the second term become? C over m, what's that? All right? K over m in this case. Negative m. You are right. Sorry about that. Okay. And then we said, hey, 2 zeta omega n. So we have an equation of motion. It relates to acceleration of that sensor body to the motion of the mass, its internal mass. So let's assume for now that this y is going to be a pure harmonic input. Okay. So I'm just going to leave it complex. Pure harmonic, but we're using that complex form. Okay. I want to figure out x of t. I can measure x of t, this displacement, right? So I need to figure out what that is, really. So that means I need to solve this differential equation. So if I have a y of t that looks like that, what should I assume x of t to be? Match that form. So we're also going to assume x of t ends up being that, right? Take the derivatives as necessary, plug them into our equation of motion, and collect terms. We end up with something like this. Minus. Okay. And we really want to get to x of t, right? So that guy goes away. We can figure out what x bar is. Okay. Now let's write out the total equation for x of t. So we found some x of t given, in this case, a complex, pure harmonic y of t. Do you notice anything about that? Let me give you a hint. What is that? That term. Yeah, so it's actually the negative acceleration of y, right? If you assume the complex, pure complex harmonic, right? So what we said, hey, that xt is that. And we, of course, we could put some kind of function there if we want. So, hey, I should be able to measure xt and get some information about what y double dot is. It's kind of interesting. Okay. Let's look at a couple cases of how I might choose the parameters in my really simple sensor here. Okay. And based on looking at these kind of two forms of that equation. Okay. Let's start with this case, where omega, which is my input frequency to the sensor, how the sensor is, the frequency of the sensor is moving up and down, is much, much less than the natural frequency of the sensor itself, omega n. Okay. If that's the case, what is this approximately? Yeah, so you end up with approximately 1/2, right? If omega is much, much less than omega n, the input frequency is way lower than the natural frequency of the sensor itself. So if I want to know something about the acceleration of y, the sensor, I can measure x. And multiply by, and I guess that is approximately, multiply by the negative natural frequency squared, which I would know because I am the one that designed the sensor and picked k and m. Okay, this is which of those kind of sensors do you think? Accelerometer, right? We're measuring, we're figuring out something about acceleration. So this case, is an accelerometer. By measuring this displacement, we can get information about the acceleration of the whole thing. Some approximation. It's kind of cool. Let's look at the other case. Say the frequency of the input is much, much greater than the natural frequency of the sensor. Okay. Well, what happens then? Look back at this form, probably. Yeah, so if omega is much, much bigger than omega n, this omega n squared term kind of goes away, that guy goes away. Get omega squared of omega squared. It's 1. It's negative. You got a negative sign there. That's right. All right. So in that case, negative sign. So my displacement is about the displacement of the input. Right? That's kind of cool too. And if the other one's an accelerometer, that one's a seismometer. Okay. Let's talk about what those two conditions mean for the design of the sensor. If I want the input frequency I'm measuring, let's look at the accelerometer case first. Input frequency I'm trying to get some information about. It'd be much, much less than the natural frequency of the sensor. What does that mean for the natural frequency of the sensor? I didn't really want it to be pretty high. Okay. Well, what was that sensor's natural frequency? K over M. So I want a high natural frequency. And we said, well, hey, omega n so let's tell you about what k and m should be. I want a high k and what about m? I want a low m. What does that tell you about how big an accelerometer can be? It can be very small. Right? I want it as lightweight and as stiff as I can make it and still be able to measure X in some way. Right? So this is why your phone has bunches of accelerometers in it. They're tiny. Right? For an accelerometer, anybody know how we generally measure X? Or a common way? There's other ways. IR sensor, not generally, right? Because this can get, I mean, again, some phones have dozens of these inside. And at minimum, you're going to have one of these for each axis, X, Y, Z, in your phone. They fit on the pinhead. Something like that. So the Pi board, if you guys came through 201 when we were using the Pi board, has an onboard accelerometer. That one's actually kind of biggish. That's, millimeter by millimeter or something when it's on that board, which is kind of a big accelerometer, generally speaking, given today's electronics. So one way, basically, is... And it's less common when you get to the sizes on the Pi board on your phone, as you have some piezoelectric here, right? So you get a current or voltage, depending on how you want to think about it, based on the deflection of this material. So if you have an acoustic electric guitar, you might have a piezoelectric pickup on the top of the guitar, right? It generates a voltage as the top is vibrating. You can read that, amplify it, and basically replicate the sound that results from that top vibrating. So similar thing here. You can basically get electrical information more or less about this displacement. Okay. But generally accelerometers can be tiny, really tiny. Okay. In the seismometer case, we want the natural frequency of our sensor to be much, much less than the excitation frequency. What does that generally mean for the natural frequency of the sensor? We want omega n to be small as possible. And I guess what I'm writing here is not strictly correct because it doesn't have to be less than 1. It just has to be less than what we're trying to measure. But I think you get the idea, right? Omega n needs to be small. Well, if we could do that same thing, omega n in that case is still k over m. So what does that mean for the relationship between the spring constant and the mass? Where I want... high mass and a low K. What does that mean for how big a seismometer is? They're large. Right. Yes?
If we're only
Yeah, if you don't have the damper there, right, this thing starts oscillating, oscillates forever. Yeah.
And it could, like, explode at some point, too.
Yeah, it'll break. Yeah, if you excite the system at the natural frequency of the sensor, you got big problems. So the damping avoids that. What does it need to be for either of these cases? The natural frequency is the dominant term, right? So the damper is picked, so you need to limit the displacement probably at your natural frequency of the sensor. So that's going to pick how far you need the damping needs to be cranked up to pull that peak down for your sensor not to break. Okay. So let's think about this a little bit more. This is big not just because M has to be large. What happens when K comes down? Yeah, it needs a lot more displacement to generate the same amount of force, right? So I need not just a big mass, but I need a big mass that can move around a lot. Right? So that's why seismometers, particularly really precise ones, are huge. And you can get estimates on how precise or what your frequency or your sensor needs to be by looking kind of at this full equation. Okay. Given my input frequency of this, I want my approximation to be good. So, okay, what's the difference between this and that? I want to be within 10% of the actual acceleration or 1% or 0.01%, whatever it needs to be. I can tell you how much higher the natural frequency of the sensor needs to be than the frequency you're trying to measure. And when you look at accelerometers, you guys will deal a lot more with accelerometers in your career than seismometers. That will often be a spec of the accelerometer. This is good between, you know, this frequency band. And quite often you'll see in a spec will have a frequency response plot of the accelerometer itself. Right. So that's something you need to consider. We have acceleration in this range and these frequencies. That means this particular accelerometer is suitable or not. Questions about accelerometers or seismometers? Okay. Let's then loop back, figure out how to measure vibration. What's that going to do for us now? If we can measure vibration, we might be able to figure out some stuff about our system, just experimentally. Let's see if we can do that. So we're going to loop back through now. Section 210. Okay. System identification. You're commonly called SysID or system ID. What system identification is really about is if I have some vibrating system sitting in front of me, can I measure stuff about how that system vibrates and then get information about its physical properties? Can I figure out what a kind of equivalent spring constant might be, or its mass, or the damping ratio, just by measuring how it vibrates? Okay. From what we've seen, I should be able to do that kind of. Well, how do I do it then is the next question. So that's what this is about. This is still, there are known methods for simple systems, kind of like the ones we talk about. This is actually still an active area of research for really complex systems, in nonlinear systems. So we'll talk more, actually, a little bit about that coming up in Chapter 3. And then your first mini project is largely a system identification project. So let's start. We're largely going to talk for now we're going to talk about one degree of freedom systems. And what we're going to discuss, strictly speaking, only applies to one degree of freedom systems. Okay? However, if you have a system where one degree of freedom is dominant, you can also use these methods. Okay? So for example, the crane stuff you've seen of mine, right? There's all kinds of frequencies. The cable itself is vibrating, the pendulum rocking back and forth a little bit, but the actual crane pendulum vibration clearly dominates that response. Right? The string vibration doesn't really do anything to affect how the payload is swinging back and forth. Right? So it has one dominant degree of freedom. So we could still use these techniques if we wanted to. And luckily, this is true for a huge number of systems where it's one frequency really dominates the response. Okay. An even larger number of systems where there's one or two frequencies dominate the response. So we'll get to the multi-degree freedom case in a couple weeks. Okay. For now, again, strictly speaking, this only works on one degree of freedom systems. In practice, as long as you have the system that's one degree of freedom that's clearly dominant, one mode is clearly dominant, you still can use these. Okay, so if I have a system and it's sitting on the table in front of me, well, I can get some information about how it oscillates. Let's use the crane, for example, since we're just talking about it. I can walk up to the crane and grab onto that hook, and I can displace it by a little ways and let go of it. Let's say I do that. Say I bring it up to theta naught. Grab the crane hook, pull it over a ways to theta naught, and let it go. What's this time plot look like? Yeah, it's sinusoidal. That crane, it's just a pendulum, basically. Right, like we said, the dominant part of that response is just a pendulum back and forth. And it has a little bit of damping, but a really, really low amount of damping. So I'm just going to draw it for now without damping. Damping so low, for the control stuff we do, we actually model it as no undamped. So we know we don't have any damping. We know that that magnitude should stay the same. What do we know about what magnitude it should reach down here if we don't have damping? Yeah, it should go exactly the opposite. Okay. Now let's see how good my sign drawing skills are. Not too bad. Okay. So I've grown up and walked up to my crane, grabbed onto the hook, displaced it a ways, over theta naught, and let it go. And then somehow recorded what the vibration was back and forth for a few cycles. I have this measure. What can you tell me about this crane right now? Well, we just discussed, hey, it doesn't have any damping because it's not really damping out. Or has really low damping, at least. What else can you tell me? Tell natural frequency. How can I do that? I can look at this plot, and I can pick off with a period of oscillation in free vibration, right? It's in free vibration. There's nothing forcing it to move this way, right? So I can look at the period. And the way we want to do that is find zero crossings. Okay. So in our case, zero is the equilibrium. If you have a non-zero equilibrium, you would want to subtract off that equilibrium and find where it crosses zero. Okay. And make sure you get an entire cycle. That's kind of a common mistake, is to just pick off half the cycle. Okay. So I have a period there. What's that related? How's that related to natural frequency? Right, second, or if I wanted it in hertz, there's one over that, right? Okay, so I have some estimate of natural frequency now. How can I improve my estimate just with the data I have already? Yeah, I have a lot of cycles here I could look at. I could look at this one. All right, and let's see, I have one more there, right? Okay, I'm off by one, aren't I? Okay. What else could I look at? So I have all these single cycles. I could look at multiple cycles. So I could look, if I start here, I have 1, 2. Did I draw that right? 1, 2, yeah, okay. And more data, I can do 3 or 4, right? Which one of these do I want to use?
Largest one.
What do you mean the largest one?
As many cycles
as possible. Why would I want to use that one?
Better array of data.
Covers more data, maybe. I might want to take some average. Let's talk about having more cycles. So what is your precision of your stopwatch, let's say, of when this crosses zero, is it fixed or is it changing?
Human error,
is there some variation, but there's some limit on that precision, and say you're in some bounds, right? So as a percentage of the total time, how's that error change over time? If your error is about the same all the time, well, if I'm just clocking here, and then I have some amount of error there. When I see it cross zero, I'm going to clock. Right? And then I wait n cycles later, and I see it cross clear, I'm going to clock, and I have some error there. It's still the same. Right? It's still two measurements. I need two measurements whether I'm taking one cycle or 15 cycles. Right? So in that case, if I have 15 cycles, the error relative to the time measurement I had is smaller. You guys follow that? So in a lot of cases, this taking multiple cycles is going to get you better information. You have a fixed error bounds on your measurement, but the range of the measurement is getting larger. Right? So you get more precise information there. That's still not going to be enough, though. Why? Do we expect all of these to be the same? And theoretically, they should be identical. In practice, are they?
No.
No. Okay. So there'll be some variation here. Okay. I say theoretically they're all the same. That's theoretically true for a certain type of system. Even a damp system, that period is going to be the same. It's just a damp period rather than undamped. Okay. But this having a fixed natural frequency means what? Linear or nonlinear? It's linear, right? So everything we were saying here really only also applies to linear systems. So what you want to do, given some data, I want to take this as many places as I can and calculate all of these taus. Okay? And then if the tau over here is significantly different than the one I got from the first cycle, it's starting to hint that, well, hey, maybe this system's not linear. So you can get information. You may not be able to get reliable natural frequency information over that range, but you still can start gathering some information about, well, this system is at least slightly nonlinear if that's changing. So again, like the one degree of freedom case, these methods only strictly hold for one degree of freedom systems that are linear, but also can be used in practice for systems where one degree of freedom is dominant and they're pretty close to being linear. Right? A pendulum is not linear, right? We have to linearize that equation in motion to get a natural frequency. But for small angles, it's pretty close to being linear, so we still can use these two methods. Okay. So, again, the book refers to this as zero crossing. Basically looking at the times of these zero crossings, you get the period. And again, what you want to do is take kind of as many measurements as you can. Right? And you want to get kind of as much time as you can. And you probably want 3 or 4 separate independent trials and compare those as well. Just kind of general good experimental hygiene. Okay, one data point doesn't really tell you a lot, in other words. Right? Okay. So there was somebody brought up, hey, that's only an undamped system. What happens when I have damping? You tell me. It's going to decay. What changes about this? Okay, let's draw up that case maybe. So what has changed? What's that? Right, so we have some decay, hopefully exponential if it's linear. Right? Well, what changes about this guy over here if we have damping? It's going to be the damped natural frequency. Right? So if we have damping, or you can, maybe, you don't see this as commonly. You end up with a damped natural frequency. If you're measuring these zero crossings. Right. Is the natural frequency of these two systems the same? Well, the natural frequency of one matches the damped natural frequency of the other. Is the natural frequency the same then? No, they're going to be different a little bit. Right. Okay. In practice, if you have light damping, you can still kind of start here. Depends on what precision you need to do your analysis at. Right.
So that's why we can approximate like a normal pendulum, there's some damping.
It's going to be damping. It has to be, right? In quote, unquote, real life, right? So it's going to, this crane would eventually stop oscillating back and forth, right? But that damping ratio is so low, right? Remember, omega D is what? In terms of natural frequency and damping ratio. One minus times what? Right. So for the crane, that zeta is so small, it's basically oscillating at the natural frequency, right? And most of the cranes I've worked on, this zeta is 0.01 to 0.005, right? So that squared is basically zero. Right. Okay, so that, strictly speaking, changes us over to measuring damped natural frequency. Well, I'd like to know something about the damping itself. How can I get to that? Well, we know, and I didn't do a good job drawing this slope maybe, right? I know that the slope of this decay should be what?
Exponential.
Yeah, it should be an exponential decay, right? And we know that that slope, okay, over there it looks okay. Is that, right? So what I can do is kind of pick off these peaks and kind of fit that curve and pick the zeta I need to fit that exponential decay to those peaks. Right? I know the shape has to be this. if it has linear viscous damping. Okay. So let's look at that. There's a method then. A logarithmic decrement, and that's an E, not an I. Okay. You'll see this called everywhere log deck. And basically what we're trying to do is figure out what zeta needs to be to fit the decay envelope we see in our actual data. Okay. X of t for a free vibration is what? Just the equation describing that for a second order harmonic oscillator. Got part of it. Can't hear you.
You have your
oscillatory terms. Right? So let's write that. Free vibration of a second order harmonic oscillator. Okay. Well, let's assume some initial conditions of this guy. It's displaced over, we'll say x, and our example over here was theta naught. Okay. And we're going to release it from rest at that initial displacement. With those initial conditions, and I got an X naught in here. Yep. Sorry, left off the X naught. I know that's going to be the free vibration response for initial displacement of x naught to the second order harmonic oscillator. If you don't get that, plug in these initial conditions and solve for A and B. I think we did that in lecture. Yes, sir? Initial condition. So the position of x at time 0 is x naught. Right. So I took my mass, for example, and pulled it over to x naught and held it there and let go at time 0. X velocity is 0. Thank you. Sorry about that. So I pulled it over, held it at rest. It was stationary when I let it go at time 0. Okay. So I know this describes the response of that system for all time after I let it go, for saying it has free, it's free vibration. Right. I pulled that guy over X naught. Let him go, and it oscillates and oscillates and oscillates. And if it has some damping, it's going to damp out towards 0. Okay? So we know each period we kind of just talked through this. It's just 2 pi over omega d. I want to look n periods into the future. To do that, I know it needed to go 2 pi n over omega d time into the future. So let's look at that. So I want to look at x n periods into the future. So I just wrote out the exponential e to the raised to the whatever, so we can actually have space to write out what's the exponential. And I wrote out omega d on the bottom part. Okay. So if I look at this guy, what kind of goes away? Okay. Well, those guys are canceling. Those omega d's cancel then. What is cosine of 2n pi, where n is some integer number? That's always 1, no matter what n is. Right? So this guy is always 1. Equal to 1 for all n. So we know that x of we know the amplitude of the oscillation in periods into the future, after we've let it go, should be that. Okay. Well, now let's take a look at the ratio between where we were at the first peak we had, the first period we had, time zero, we were here, right? I want to compare that to this guy. So what I'm going to write is the amplitude we had at time zero, our first peak of oscillation, to what our amplitude is n periods later. Okay. Well, we just had x naught on top that cancels the x naught on the bottom. Right. And we can simplify out and figure out should be a zeta there, I think. Give me 1 second. On the top side, too. Yes. Okay. So why the heck are we doing this? Well, what this is saying, what this, if you look at this, well, this expression over here only depends on zeta. Right, there's no natural frequency showing up there. There's no time terms for us to worry about. Right? So if I can compare, somehow measure n periods, n peaks, after my initial peak of oscillation, then that's just a function of damping ratio. You guys seeing that? Well, if that's just a function of damping ratio, that gives me a way, if I can measure these two things, to then solve for what the damping ratio has to be to see that amount of decay over those n periods. Okay. So if you do that, I'm going to write this out because I never remember the long form. Okay. If I'm going to solve that, I need to take the natural log of both sides, right? I'm going to define okay. If I do that and I define sigma that way and I solve this guy out, what I find Let's find that. If zeta is very small, okay, we have a really lightly damped system, we would say. Okay. Then that's true. Okay. So this is the kind of a little bit of background on why log deck works. Okay. So how do I actually use this thing? Okay. Time. And let's say I have some oscillation. Okay. What I want to do is pick off the first peak, which may or may not happen at when your stopwatch started at time zero. I'm going to pick this first guy and say, hey, that is time zero. You get to define that, right? You get to figure out what time zero is. Okay. Then I'm going to look at the peak n periods into the future. All right, so this is, what, 2, right? 1 period, 2 periods in the future. Okay. So that would be x of 2 tau. N is equal to 2 in that case. Measure the amplitude here. Measure the amplitude there. Okay. That gives me the sigma term. Okay. Once I have that sigma term, I can estimate what zeta is. Okay. That's log deck. This is a really common technique. So, given what we just said, how could I, about natural frequency, how could I improve my estimation of damping ratio? Yeah, so I could do different points. So, for example, maybe I look at that point as x0 and that point. Okay, and I call, say, let this be x0 for my equation. Or maybe I look that one, just one peak. Or I look 4 or 5. I can look at both sides of the curve. Yes, sir?
N has to be a whole number, correct?
Yes. Yeah, so you're looking for peaks, right? So this gives you a full. All right. So I can do kind of the same thing we advocated back here. Measure this in a bunch of different ways. Look at what the trends are. Okay. What happens if you start getting damping ratios that are changing a lot? What does that indicate about your system? It's probably nonlinear. Right? And in fact, that's what's going to happen if you have a system where the dominant dissipation is from friction. Like we've talked about, that friction decay envelope is linear. If you do a log deck on a linear decay envelope, this zeta is going to be different every period. Log decrement. Again, this one's used a lot. You'll see this one in your career. I'd be surprised if you didn't. We actually did a project on this in my graduate vibrations class. So the professor there, he does, I mentioned this is still active area research, he does all these nonlinear fancy system ID stuff. He gave us one of his benchmark problems he solves for his research. The class, we all did what we were taught in class, log deck and a few fancier things. And we were within a 1% of what his method does. Like he averaged across the whole class and whatever. So these simple methods, and I tell you that, these simple methods can get you a lot of pretty good information about your system. Okay. So again, like I said, Thursday, We'll probably work a few more example problems, talk in more detail about what will be on the exam. And I should have the homework solutions up by then too.